Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument in the matter of Parker. Insert Corporation versus Mae Jean Parker. Justice Doggett is recused in this matter and will not participate in the decision.
Mr. Michael Nagel will represent the argument for the petition.
May it please the court. My name is Mike Knopik. I'm with the Dallas law firm of Jackson Walker. I'm here on behalf of the petitioner, InSearch Corporation, DBA, Lone Star Gas Company. Your Honor, this case arises out of an incident which occurred in February of 1984, wherein two employees of the respondent, J.W. Bill Christie, Inc., were killed while servicing gas lines as employees of Christie. Christie was an independent contractor retained by InSearch to service gas lines owned by InSearch, pursuant to an agreement that was entered into prior to the accident, the agreement being between InSearch and Christie. Plaintiffs filed suit originally against Lone Star Gas Company of Texas, a subsidiary of InSearch, and against Christie nearly 2 years after the accident occurred. Some 18 months later, the plaintiffs amended their petition, substituting InSearch as a party defendant. InSearch filed a cross-claim for indemnity against Christie, pursuant to the agreement that had been previously entered into between the parties. InSearch filed a motion for summary judgment against the plaintiffs, contending that it owed no duty to the employees of Christie as employees of an independent contractor, and also based upon limitations. InSearch also filed a motion for summary judgment against Christie pursuant to the indemnity provision in the agreement between the parties. Christie filed a cross motion for summary judgment as well. The district court in Dallas granted InSearch's motions for summary judgment both as to the plaintiffs and as to Christie. However, the district court did not rule upon Christie's motion for summary judgment. The Dallas Court of Appeals reversed the summary judgment on behalf of InSearch against the plaintiffs and remanded the case back to trial. The Dallas Court of Appeals reversed the summary judgment that had been granted by the trial court in favor of InSearch against Christie on the indemnity issue and rendered judgment in favor of Christie, even though Christie had not obtained a ruling on its motion for summary judgment in the trial court. From this court's notice, this court is interested in hearing the arguments concerning the indemnity issues between InSearch and Christie. As a result, I will focus on those arguments, and if there are any questions concerning any other points, I can respond to those at this time as well, assuming there's time permitting. Your Honors, InSearch submits that the Court of Appeals erred in reversing the summary judgments entered by the trial court in favor of InSearch in this matter, and that this court should reverse the Court of Appeals and affirm the trial court's judgment. The Court of Appeals, in reversing the summary judgment entered by the trial court on behalf of InSearch against Christie, did so solely based upon Article 8306, Section 3D of the Workers' Compensation Act. As this court knows, the common rationale in cases discussing whether or not an indemnity is entitled to indemnity or the consequences of its own alleged negligence discussed fair notice or notice to the indemnitor. Was the indemnitor aware that it was indemnifying the indemnity or the consequences of its own alleged negligence? InSearch submits that in this case, Christie was in fact aware that it was indemnifying InSearch for any claims concerning InSearch's negligence. The agreement between the parties was dated October 5, 1983, which preceded the accident that is the basis of this case. In paragraph 1 of that agreement between InSearch and Christie, Christie agreed to provide all tools, equipment, and labor to perform their work. There was another paragraph in the contract specifying that Christie was an independent contractor. Paragraph 3 indicated that Christie agreed that it shall maintain the work site and general location involved in the work in a safe and workmanlike condition at all times. Paragraph 9 of the contract between InSearch and Christie specified that Christie assumed the responsibility for and liability for the claims asserted against InSearch for the death or injuries to persons in connection with or to have arisen out of or incidental to the performance of the contract by Christie, regardless of whether those claims or actions are founded in whole or in part upon the alleged negligence of InSearch. The Court of Appeals in this case correctly determined that the language in the agreement between Christie and InSearch satisfied this court's express negligence test that was pronounced in EPA Corporation versus Daniel Construction Company. This court noted in that case that the purpose of that test is to put the parties on notice that the indemnitor is indemnifying the indemnity for the consequences of its own negligence. This test was recently reiterated by this court in April of 1989 in Atlantic Richfield Company versus Petroleum Personnel, Inc., where this court held that the indemnitor was aware that it was indemnifying the indemnity for the consequences of its own negligence, although there was no differentiation in the agreement between different degrees of negligence. In this case, Your Honors, Christie agreed to indemnify InSearch regardless of whether any claims were found in whole or in part on InSearch's negligence, which is exactly the language that the Fourth Court of Appeals approved of in BFW Construction Company, Inc. versus Garza, where the court held that the language, quote, regardless of any cause or of any fault or negligence of the indemnity, end quote, satisfied the express negligence test as a matter of law. The Court of Appeals in this case, however, erred in reversing the summary judgment granted in favor of InSearch against Christie with respect to the indemnity issue on the issue as to whether or not Article 8306, Section 3B of the Workers' Compensation Act barred that claim. Your Honor, we would initially point out to the court that there's nothing that I have been able to find in the record indicating that Christie is a subscribing employer entitling Christie to benefits under the Workers' Compensation Act. Furthermore, Section 3D nowhere states that the term workers' compensation has to be specifically mentioned. Nowhere does it state that the indemnitor's employees have to be specifically mentioned. Your Honors, we submit that this case, the facts of this case are in line with the facts of the case in Versant All Steel Press Company versus Carrier, a case of the Tyler Court of Appeals in which this court refused the writ of error application with a notation NRE. In that case, Your Honors, the issue was whether or not Article 8306, Section 3D barred the indemnity's claims for indemnity. The indemnity provision between the parties in that case stated that the indemnitor was indemnifying the indemnity for claims or as a result of injuries or death of any person or persons. The language in the contract between InSearch and Christie refers to persons. The indemnitor in that case, as Christie in this case, argued that the term workers' compensation had to be specifically mentioned and that the indemnitor's employees had to be specifically mentioned. The court in Versant All Steel held that position was unrealistic, stating that in analyzing the sufficiency of indemnity contracts entered into by subscribers, the intent of the parties is still to be gleaned from examining all provisions of the contract in light of the circumstances surrounding its execution. In analyzing the contract in Versant All Steel, the court looked at the entire agreement between the parties to determine if the employees of the indemnitor were covered by the indemnity provision. In that case, Your Honors, paragraph 7 of the agreement between the parties stated that the indemnitor agreed to maintain the equipment that was at issue in a safe manner, and the court in Versant All Steel held that necessarily the people who would be operating the equipment would be the indemnitor's employees. And as a result, the reference to any person or persons necessarily included the indemnitor's employees. The court in Versant All Steel relied upon the Court of Appeals opinion in American Petrofina, Inc. versus Dorchester Gas Corporation, which was, in our opinion, reversed on other grounds by this court. In the Court of Appeals opinion in American Petrofina, the court discussed Section 3D of Article 8306. In that case, there was an indemnity provision for claims from the use or operation of the properties. The Court of Appeals determined that the indemnitor's employee was injured from the use or operations of the properties and therefore held that 8306 Section 3D was satisfied. This court reversed the opinion in American Petrofina, but only discussing whether or not the first hurdle was overcome. That is, was the indemnity's negligence covered by the indemnity provision, which was subject to the clear and unequivocal test at that time. This court held that the language was not sufficient to cover the negligence of the indemnity, and this court never got to the issue as to whether or not Article 8306, Section 3D was satisfied. In this case, Your Honors, in paragraph 1, Christie agreed to provide all labor equipment and tools to perform their work under the contract. In paragraph 3, Christie agreed to maintain the work site and general location involved in the work in a safe and workmanlike condition at all times. The indemnity provision in paragraph 9 was limited to claims in connection with Christie's work. Insert submits to this court that Christie was put on notice that it was indemnifying, that Christie was put on notice and it was indemnifying Insert for the consequences of Insert's own alleged negligence, and that the express negligence test pronounced by this court was satisfied. Furthermore, as the individuals or the persons who would necessarily be at the work site that Christie agreed to maintain in a safe and workmanlike condition at all times wouldn't necessarily include Christie employees, it's our position, Your Honors, that the paragraph referencing the indemnity to cover claims or injuries or death to any person to persons would necessarily cover Christie's employees. In their response to the application for writ of error, Christie cites to several cases contending that the language in the agreement between Insert and Christie was not sufficient. For example, they cite to the Robert H. Smith, Inc. case versus Tennessee Title Company. In that case, the language stated that the indemnity was provided to the indemnity without limit to employee benefit acts. The court in Versant Allsteel versus Carrier said you don't need that. That workers' compensation is not, the term workers' compensation is not required. I would note that the Robert A. Smith case was decided by the Houston Court of Appeals without a writ history. The Versant Allsteel Press Company versus Carrier case, the application for writ of error was refused by this court, NRE. Additionally, in the Port Royal case, which is cited by the respondent Christie, and Charter Builders case, which is cited and relied upon by the respondent Christie, those cases were under the clear and unequivocal test that was in effect at that time. It's the position of Insurge that those cases are not applicable, as the hurdle of whether or not the indemnity negligence was covered for anybody, for any claims of anybody, was not cleared. The courts in both the Port Royal and Charter Builders case held that the clear and unequivocal test for the indemnity's own negligence was not satisfied. It's our position that the courts in those cases didn't even need to get to the Article 8306, Section 3D issue. Furthermore, in those cases that are relied upon by the respondent, there was no reference or no indication that there was anything else in the agreement between the parties, as there was in Versant Allsteel and as there is in this case, to indicate that the employees of the indemnitor were covered and included in the phraseology of the agreement to entitle the indemnity to indemnity. Additionally, Your Honors, in those cases, in the Port Royal and the Charter Builders case, there was evidence that the indemnitor was the subscriber. As I indicated, there's no evidence in this case that the indemnitor, Christie, was a subscriber to the Workers' Compensation Act or was a subscribing employer and therefore not entitled to benefits of the Workers' Compensation Act. I would refer the court to the recent case of Aerospatial Helicopter versus Universal Health Services, Inc., that was decided out of the Dallas Court of Appeals this year, 1989, found at 778 Southwest 2nd, 492, where Nevada Corporation was arguing that the Article 8306, Section 3D bar applied. The court held that there was no evidence that the employer was a subscribing employer and therefore could not take advantage of anything under the workers' compensation. Your Honors, Insert submits that the trial court was correct in granting summary judgment on behalf of Insert in this case against Christie on the indemnity issue. The Court of Appeals erred in reversing the trial court summary judgment on behalf of Insert. Furthermore, the trial court erred in rendering judgment on behalf of Christie against Insert. As I've pointed out to the court, Christie filed a cross motion for summary judgment. The trial court did not rule upon Christie's cross motion for summary judgment. As a result, it's the position of Insert that Christie cannot complain of anything concerning its cross motion for summary judgment, and that the Court of Appeals as a result erred in rendering judgment on behalf of Christie against Insert. Your Honor,
the Court of Appeals empowered to on that summary judgment issue, Mr. Christie, to render the judgment the trial court could have rendered?
Your Honor, it's our position there was nothing before the Court of Appeals and to entitle it to do so, that it was tantamount to Christie have not having filed a motion for summary judgment.
But Christie had filed a motion for summary judgment.
They did, Your Honor, but it was never ruled upon. And one of the points raised in Christie's brief was that the trial court erred in overruling their motion for summary judgment. And the Court of Appeals expressly sustained that point of error.
Seems plausible that if a motion for summary judgment of one side is granted and the motion for the other side is not acted upon, that it's by implication denied.
I think that's
that law on that point?
No, Your Honor, I do not. I do have law on the point of motions in general, that if a motion is not acted upon by the trial court, that the party who filed the motion cannot complain of anything in connection with that motion. I have a case, Portland Savings and Loan Association versus Bernstein, 716 Southwest 2nd 532, out of the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals, 1985 NRE decision. Crook versus Williams Drug Company, Tyler Court of Civil Appeals, 1977 NRE. Marino versus, which is found at 558 Southwest 2nd 500. Marino versus Jenkins, 436 Southwest 2nd 620, out of the Austin Court of Civil Appeals, 1968 NRE. And Steve Tyrell Productions, Inc. versus Ray, 674 Southwest 2nd 430, out of the Austin Court of Appeals, 1984, no writ history. Admittedly, Your Honors, there's nothing in those cases. I found no case law where a summary judgment was discussed in exactly the same manner that you just asked. However, those cases state the broad general principle that if a motion is filed with the trial court and is not acted upon by the trial court, the party cannot complain about anything concerning that motion.
Is it still out there in limbo somewhere?
It is, Your Honor.
Then the judgment of the trial court wasn't the final judgment.
It was final in that it granted all of the relief that could have been granted with respect to granting the summary judgment on behalf of InSearch against Christie for the indemnity.
Granted, it would be better practice for the trial court to overrule one motion and to grant the other when he has competing motions like that. Is it a necessary corollary to say that, well, they didn't get a ruling on it, even though they filed it and the other side was granted?
Your Honor, I think that it's our position that the most the Court of Appeals could have done in reversing the trial court's judgment would have been to remand the case back to the trial court and not render judgment against Christie on the indemnity issue. I'm sorry, render judgment against InSearch on the indemnity issue. Your Honors, that concludes my argument with respect to the indemnity issues. If there are no other questions, I will conclude my argument. Thank you.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please report Mr. Michael Hoveston to present the argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. With respect to the one procedural issue that came up right at the very end of the presentation of petitioners, we would submit that in Cord versus General Motors, the court indicated there that, for example, in a jury charge instance, where the charge did not include a requested instruction, and the court submitted something else, that the court could imply a ruling that there had been a denial of the request for an instruction. We believe that that would be the same case here, where you had two motions for summary judgment pending on all fours, right identical, flip sides of the same coin, and the court chooses one side of the coin. Well, the reversal on this appeal should, in effect, result in the flip of the other coin. The court, at the very least, impliedly overruled the motion for rehearing filed by respondents as a result of its disposition of the motion filed by the petitioners. With respect to the question on the whether or not Christie was a subscriber, it's a rather amazing argument because this case has been pending for an awfully long time. We went through summary judgments. We went through briefing on summary judgments. Went through the pleading from the case where the plaintiffs have sued our client for gross negligence to try to avoid the comp bar. And now for the first time, when we get before this court, there is an argument raised that somehow Christie wasn't a subscriber. It has been undisputed throughout this case that Christie was a subscriber to the Workers' Compensation Act. It should have been raised at the trial court if they had a problem with it. it certainly should have been raised to the Court of Appeals, because what they're asking this court to do now is to say, Court of Appeals, you were wrong for a reason we never told you about. And that is just not a proper method of trying to raise error in this court. It's been conceded, been undisputed from day one. Now, with respect to the indemnity agreement, there are three attacks that this court must consider. First, the compact, the express assumption language. Second, whether the indemnity agreement was conspicuous. And third, the express negligence rule. As we'll submit later in this argument, there's confusion of the first question, the express assumption language in the compact, and the express negligence rule. Deliberately confused, it's been confused by the courts. This court has an opportunity in this case to straighten out that confusion. To understand 8306-3D and the express assumption provision, it's helpful to go back and look at the history of that provision. It was adopted in August of 1963 by the legislature. Prior to that time, the comp bar did not refer in any way to indemnity causes of action. So the court held that, of course, an indemnity cause of action could be brought in derogation of the comp bar. The legislature recognized, and correctly so, that this end run on the comp bar would have the effect of diminishing the effectiveness of the comp bar because it could be avoided. And that there were three very important purposes of the comp bar that the court and that the legislature felt were being affected by that type of end run. First, constitutional, because the defendant gave up his constitutional, his common law defenses and accepted more certain liability under the compact in exchange for the protection of the comp bar. That's one purpose that was to be served by the comp bar. The other was practical, that if it was not truly effective, it would not entice employers to go ahead and accept and get in and subscribe to the Workers' Compensation Act. And the third purpose to be served, it was being the end run was being effectuated on, was the fact that there's a dual insurance burden where you allow these end runs, that the employer must first get workers' compensation insurance, but then has to get additional insurance to cover the same risk, injuries to employees, to protect himself against the indemnity claims. The solution chosen by the legislature was to include the next to last sentence that's in Section 3D as we have it now, and that is a requirement that there be an express assumption for liability on account of injuries to employees. What did the court mean, or what did the legislature mean by express? Why did it choose that language? Well, let's look. The legislature is charged with knowledge of the law in place at the time that they enacted the statute. And at that time, if you go by analogy to the cases interpreting indemnity agreements and whether or not they are valid to indemnify one for their own negligence, the test being used at that point in time was the then-developing clear and unequivocal test. So the legislature could have chosen that language. And this court has very, very distinctly pointed out in Fireman's Fund, as well as in Atlantic Richfield and in Ethel versus Daniel, that there's a difference between something that's express and something that is clear and unequivocal. The legislature chose the express language, and we would submit that they wanted a harsher standard. And that standard is to focus on a different inquiry from the express negligence rule. Call it, if you will, an express employee rule or express waiver of the comp bar rule, because that's the focus of inquiry, is there an express waiver of the comp bar, either by an express statement to that effect or by reference to the fact the indemnity agreement is to apply to claims by employees. Now, if you just look at the plain and ordinary definition of the term express, it gives some guidance as to the fact that there is a heightened standard required here. Common definition, just right out of Webster's. Express means direct and unmistakable terms, explicitly, definitely. It's the antithesis of implicit or implied types of provisions. And indeed, this court's decisions in Ethel and Atlantic Richfield make clear that if you have to deduce the scope of the indemnity agreement from the terms, or if you have to search around the contract to find something from which you can deduce what it covers, in this case, whether it truly is intended to cover claims of employees, that is not express. So even going by analogy again to the express negligence rule cases, we have a heightened test under the statute. How have the cases treated this provision historically? This court has had two opportunities to look at the issue, but has not directly addressed it in either case. In fact, hadn't addressed it at all. First case is McCann, decided in 1971. And there the court noted that it couldn't address 8306 because of the fact that the contract there had been entered into prior to the time the amendment was adopted, adding the express assumption language. Implicit in what the court said is that the clear and unequivocal test, which it used to decide the case, in other words, whether indemnity was provided for their own negligence, was different from 8306. Otherwise, why was there a need to even discuss the fact that 8306 wasn't available? But all that aside, the court had another opportunity, or at least it looked like the court had an opportunity to address it in Dorchester versus American Petrofan. And they referred to the Court of Appeals decision from that case, and it is essential to note that the Court of Appeals did not address whether 8306 subsection 3B had a separate meaning. Didn't address it at all in that case. In fact, the opinion specifically states that it was indeed conceded, and that's at 685 Southwest 2nd on page 725, undisputed, that provision didn't provide any additional test. So that wasn't decided in that case. It can't be support for their position in this case. It certainly was improper for Versen to use it for support in that case. Indeed, when you look at the application for writ of error that was filed in this court, at page 16 of the application for writ of error, it again concedes that they're not arguing for a separate test. All they want to talk about is the clear and unequivocal rule. That's all that was decided. But interestingly, in oral argument in that case, the question was posed from the bench from Justice Kilgarland, and he asked whether or not there was a heightened standard. Otherwise, he asked, what is the purpose of this express assumption language? The Supreme Court didn't get to answer the question in that case. The courts of appeals have addressed it on numerous occasions. First, indemnity contracts, courts have held, that have an express reference to suits by employees have been found to be enforceable. Robert H. Smith, McCutcheon. Indemnity contracts with an express waiver of the comp bar, saying we waive the comp bar, or something to that effect, have been found to be enforceable. Robert H. Smith case. The courts have also held that if the contract does not include either of those approaches, it's not enforceable. Port Royal, Charter Builders. In summary, the courts have consistently held that there must be either an express assumption or an express assumption in the form of a waiver or an express reference to suits by employees. There is one and only one exception under Texas law, and that's Versen. And we would submit, with all deference to the Title Court of Appeals, Versen is wrong. But we don't even have to prove that it's wrong in this case to win, because of the fact that the Court of Appeals here held that there was, unlike Versen, there was no other provision here that supplied the missing link to tell us that employees were intended to be covered by the agreement. Let's get to why Versen is wrong, because it's a problem that exists in the case law in this state that needs to be resolved and can only be resolved by this court. In Versen, the provision said that it covered any person or persons. Okay? That wasn't enough. And they recognized that under 8306, they needed to do something a little bit more. There had to be something there. So what they proceeded to do was apply the clear and unequivocal test, suggesting that somehow, if it met the test for indemnifying someone against their own negligence, that was enough to meet the express provision of the comp bar that you had to have an express reference somehow to the fact that you're assuming liability for an employee. Of course, that's wrong. The court goes on through sort of a Sherlock Holmes approach of wandering through the different provisions of the contract, trying to find a provision from which it could deduce, again contrary to Ethel and Atlantic Richfield, but again trying to find something from which it could deduce that employees were to be covered. And it found one. There was a warranty that said, the indemnity said, when I sell you this machine and it gets completely out of my control, and you got it, you're in charge of putting safety devices on it for your users and operators. The court said, well, users and operators must include employees, and only employees. So that's how Versen reached its result. And again, in this case, we don't have that kind of language. The Court of Appeals held, specifically held, nothing in the contract here supplies the missing link is in verse. But amazingly, again, for the first time, as we stand up here for oral argument, petitioner has said, there is other language. You can't find that argument in the motion for rehearing. You can't find it in the application for writ of error, but it's never been raised. The Court of Appeals challenged the petitioners when they wrote their opinion. Come up with this language if it exists. We challenge them in the response to the application. Point out the language that would meet verse if it exists. It's never been raised. And indeed, the language they refer to today is very different from verse. Because in this contract, you're talking about a much broader scope. It covers all claims arising out of the performance of the work. It also provides for maintenance in the workplace. But they're not just employees to be protected here. This isn't like a machine that's totally left the control of the indemnity. Because here, there is possible injury to employees. There's possible injury to third parties. We're dealing with a gas pipeline here. Property damage as a result of the gas pipeline exploding while they're doing the process. That's very different from what was involved in Burson and hadn't been raised in this case, and it's too late to raise it for the first time on oral argument before this court. Now, there are additional reasons for why Burson is inapplicable and why it's wrong. First, the court, by seizing upon the clear and unequivocal rule as being the only way that you can test 8306, ignores 8306. It has a separate and independent purpose. Is there an express assumption of suits brought on account of employees? That's a different inquiry from whether there's an express assumption of negligence for the indemnity. They totally read it out. Next, they do erroneously equate the express assumption rule with a clear and unequivocal rule. And by dancing through these different provisions and using the Sherlock Holmes approach, we have what is in effect indemnity by implication, not express reference, not express assumption. Next, they misapply the clear and unequivocal rule. First of all, they suggest that any and all language is effective. Never been found effective, not since Milton versus Friedman back in the 1950s. Any and all language won't do the trick. Even if you apply the clear and unequivocal rule, it used to have the infamous third exception to Fireman's Fund about suits involving employees. Well, even there, the courts held, particularly in Ohio Oil, even there had to be an express reference in the contract to suits by employees. Of course, they admit that the court relied upon the decision in American Petrothena. American Petrothena was overruled. American Petrothena did not interpret 8306, simply did not. The McCann decision relied upon in person, as we've already discussed, couldn't decide 8306 and its meaning, whether it had a separate meaning, because of the fact the contract there was entered into prior to the time the amendment became effective. Very important to note cases from other jurisdictions, and we found a lot in getting ready for this argument. We'll provide a letter brief that's going to happen. One is essential, and that is the Brown decision from the Washington Supreme Court, and it's been followed by the Maine Supreme Court, the Ohio Supreme Court, and by the Utah courts. Every court, in fact, that we've been able to find that addresses the issue. And there they said, same any and all language, all-inclusive language, no reference to employees. So number one, the comp bar is important. It's the backbone of the comp act. And if you allow indemnity agreements to freely be entered into without stringent rules, the purpose is going to be defeated. So here's what the court held. An indemnity agreement of this type is enforceable only if it clearly and specifically contains a waiver of the immunity of the comp act, either by so stating or by specifically in stating that the indemnitor assumes potential liability for actions brought by its own employees. We would submit that 8306 has to be given separate meaning by this court, and that the separate meaning requires at the very least a reference to employees, not the Sherlock Holmes approach of Burson of searching through the contract to try to find a provision. That leads to the second issue of conspicuousness, and that's the most difficult issue in terms of this Sherlock Holmes search, because this is what the indemnitor has to search for. Search through this dense forest of black print. You have to have a magnifying glass virtually to read this thing. There's no identifying heading. There's no contrast in color or print. And this court has held in Goodyear, the Courts of Appeals, in K&S, and in Safeway, that an indemnity provision has to give fair notice. That's not just clear terms. It has to be conspicuous. And they've looked to the UCC as a guide. And in this case, there is nothing done to make it conspicuous. I've never heard an argument in response to that. Of course, the Court of Appeals said it wasn't raised in the response to the motion for summary judgment. But indeed it was. Look at page 698 in the transcript, and it's there. We tried to get the Court of Appeals to correct it on motion for rehearing, but they didn't do it. Yes, they decided to go ahead and deny the rehearing and move this case along its way. But the issue was raised. Conspicuousness hadn't been satisfied. Third issue, express negligence. This court has held that it's going to dissuade scriveners from trying to do everything they can to meet the test to show that express negligence is involved, but leave it just ambiguous enough that they can fool somebody into signing up for one of these ruinous awards of damages possible under an indemnity provision. And in the Atlantic Richfield and in the Ethel case, the court said we're going to cut through all this ambiguity and all the lawsuits that result from this, and we're going to require parties to say it in so many terms. In this case, very, very, very interesting device used. When you look at the indemnity provision, divide it into two parts. First part, and it's in paragraph 9, the first part is an exculpatory clause. That's where the language, regardless of the negligence of the indemnity, that's where that language is at. It doesn't talk about indemnity, it talks about Lone Star Gas. That's where the reference is. When you get to the second paragraph is where they finally use the word indemnity and hold harmless. And there, the Court of Appeals said, well, we understand that creates a little bit of a problem, but we think this one reference in there to claims, quote, in respect to any such matters, that's enough to make it express. Okay, so you read the first provision and get that regardless language, which was very close even in Atlantic Richfield as far as whether or not it was going to meet express negligence test. It did. But we have the additional factor here, the fact that you have to go down to the second paragraph where you finally get indemnity language and then shoot right back up to the top to try to connect it up with the regardless language. And again, the Court of Appeals said in respect to any such matters incorporates that whole first paragraph and all of the scope in that first paragraph. And what's interesting is that apparently this fine print was so difficult to get through that the Court of Appeals even quoted the provision incorrectly, because what it really says is in respect of any such matters, which adds additional confusion.
Thank you, Jeff.
Your Honor, in response, the respondent's attorney contends that inserts never raise anything concerning whether or not Christie was a subscribing employer before now. While that may be correct in that there is no express statement in the briefs concerning whether or not Christie was a subscribing employer, InSearch has always had a point of error in the motion for rehearing, had a point of error before this court, that the Court of Appeals erred in reversing the summary judgment of the trial court and holding that Christie was not liable for the indemnity claims of InSearch. Your Honor, we contend that is an element which we are allowed to bring at this time, and that it is subsumed by the point of error that was in the motion for rehearing and is in the application for writ of error. Additionally, Your Honors, we would also use the same argument with respect to reviewing the other provisions of the contract in this case. It's interesting that, and I think it's fairly common, that when a party does not like a case, like the facts of the case, and there's no real ability to reconcile the facts of a particular case with the case at hand, that the common argument is just to argue that case is wrong. This court denied the writ of error application in the Versen case with a notation, no reversible error. We contend again, Your Honors, that Versen-Allsteel is on point in this case, and that you cannot ignore the other provisions of a contract between the parties. The respondent would have this court rule that the indemnity provision's got to be in one sentence, and you can't go anywhere else to determine what the parties, what the contract says as to what the parties meant by the indemnity provision. This court, in refusing the application for writ of error NRE in Verson, Your Honors, it's our position that Verson holds otherwise, that you can look at the entire agreement. In fact, the court expressly states, in analyzing the sufficiency of indemnity contracts, the intent of the parties is still to be gleaned from examining all provisions of the contract in light of the circumstances surrounding its execution. In this case, Your Honors, the indemnitor, Christie, was responsible for maintaining the worksite in a safe manner, as the indemnitor was responsible in Verson for maintaining the equipment safely. The court in Verson did not state that the only people who would be using the equipment would be the employees of the indemnitor, but that it would merely include the indemnitor's employees. It's our position that necessarily the individuals would be on the worksite of Christie, for which Christie had the responsibility of maintaining in a safe manner, would be Christie's employees. The position taken by the respondent in this case, that there must be an express waiver of the workers' compensation statute to satisfy Section 3D and an express express reference to suits by employees of the indemnitor, is totally contrary to the decision in Verson Allsteel. Furthermore, with respect to the express negligence reference that the Court of Appeals held was satisfied in this case, we again contend that you can look at the entire agreement, as the court in Verson Allsteel indicated you should, to determine the intent of the parties and to glean the intent of the parties from the agreement, and that the sentence that the respondent complains of that contains the phrase, in respect of any such matters, the Court of Appeals correctly held, referenced, and pertained to the first sentence, holding that the express negligence test of this court is satisfied. Your Honors, that's all I have, and I'll conclude my argument and respectfully pray that this court reverse the judgments of the trial court, of the Court of Appeals, and affirm the summary judgment entered on behalf of insert by the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in this clause. Foregoing arguments are submitted on brief and oral arguments. That concludes the business of the court for the day, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
Yeah,